Chapter 5.
It's a woman's foot,
Arthur Levin asserted. This remark, made in a strangled voice, did not surprise me at all. It confirmed my own opinion. The slimness, the elegance, the singular beauty of the footprint had disturbed me profoundly. There could be no doubt as to the humanness of the foot. Perhaps it belonged to an adolescent or to a small man, but with much more likelihood, and this I hoped with all my heart, to a woman.
So, Soror is inhabited by humans,
Professor Antel murmured. There was a hint of disappointment in his voice, which made me, at that moment, less well-disposed towards him. He shrugged his shoulders with a gesture that was familiar to him, and joined us in inspecting the sand round the lake. We discovered other footprints, obviously left by the same creature. Levin, who had moved away from the water's edge, drew our attention to one on the dry sand. The print itself was still damp.
"She was here less than 5 minutes ago," the young man exclaimed.
"She was bathing, heard us coming, and fled."
It had become an implicit fact for us that the subject under discussion was a woman. We fell silent, scanning the forest, without hearing so much as the noise of a branch breaking.
"We've got all the time in the world," said the professor, shrugging his shoulders again. "But if a human being bathed here, we could no doubt do the same without any danger."
Without further ado, the learned scientist likewise shed his clothes and plunged his skinny body into the pool. After our long voyage, the pleasure of this bathe in cool, delicious water made us almost forget our recent discovery. Arthur Levin alone seemed harassed and lost in thought. I was about to make a taunting remark on his melancholy expression, when I saw the woman just above us, perched on the rocky ledge from which the cascade fell. I shall never forget the impression her appearance made on me. I held my breath at the marvelous beauty of this creature from Soror, who revealed herself to us dripping with spray, illuminated by the blood-red beams of Betelgeuse. It was a woman. A young girl, rather, unless it was a goddess. She boldly asserted her femininity in the light of this monstrous sun, completely naked and without any ornament other than her hair, which hung down to her shoulders. True, we had been deprived of any point of comparison for over 2 years, but none of us was inclined to fall a victim to mirages. It was plain to see that the woman, who stood motionless on the ledge like a statue on a pedestal, possessed the most perfect body that could be conceived on earth. Levin and I were breathless, lost in admiration, and I think even Professor Antel was moved. Standing upright, leaning forward, her breasts thrust out towards us, her arms raised slightly backwards in the attitude of a diver taking off, she was watching us, and her surprise clearly equaled our own. After gazing at her for a long time, I was so dazzled that I could not discern any particular feature. Her body as a whole hypnotized me. It was only after several minutes that I perceived she belonged to the white race, that her skin was golden rather than bronzed, that she was tall, but not excessively so, and slender. Then I noticed, as though in a dream, a face of singular purity. Finally, I looked at her eyes. Then my faculties of observation were awakened, my attention became sharper, and I stiffened, for in her expression there was an element that was new to me. In it I discerned the outlandish, mysterious quality which all of us had been expecting in a world so distant from our own. But I was unable to analyze or even define the nature of this oddity. I only sensed an essential difference from individuals of our own species. It did not arise from the color of her eyes. They were of a grayish hue, not often found among us, but nevertheless not uncommon. The anomaly lay in their emanation, a sort of void, an absence of expression, reminding me of a wretched mad girl I'd once known.
But no, it was not that. It could not be madness. When she saw that she herself was an object of curiosity, or, to be more accurate, when my eyes met hers, she seemed to receive a shock and abruptly looked away with an automatic gesture as swift as that of a frightened animal. It was not out of shame at being thus noticed. I had a feeling that it would have been extravagant to suppose her capable of such a sentiment. It was simply that her gaze would not, or could not, withstand mine. With her head turned to one side, she now watched us stealthily out of the corner of her eye.
"As I told you, it's a woman," young Levin muttered.
He had spoken in a voice stifled with emotion, almost a whisper. But the young girl heard him, and the sound of his voice produced a strange effect on her. She recoiled, but so swiftly that once again I compared her movement to the reflex of a frightened animal pausing before taking flight. She stopped, however, after taking two steps backwards, the rocks then concealing most of her body. I could discern no more than the top of her head and an eye that was still trained on us. We dared not move a muscle, tortured by the fear of seeing her rush away. Our attitude reassured her. After a moment, she stepped out again onto the edge of the ledge. But young Levin was decidedly too excited to be able to hold his tongue.
"Never in my life," he began.
He stopped, realizing his imprudence. She had recoiled in the same manner, as though the human voice terrified her. Professor Antel motioned us to keep quiet and started splashing about in the water without appearing to pay her the slightest attention. We adopted the same tactics, which met with complete success. Not only did she step forward once more, but she soon showed a visible interest in our movements, an interest which manifested itself in a rather unusual manner, rousing our curiosity all the more. Have you ever watched a timid puppy on the beach while his master is bathing? He longs to join him in the water, but dares not. He takes three steps in one direction, three in another, draws away, scampers back, shakes his head, paws the ground. Such, exactly, was the behavior of this girl. And all of a sudden we heard her. But the sounds she uttered only added to the impression of animality created by her attitude. She was then standing on the very edge of her perch, as though about to fling herself into the lake. She had broken off her sort of dance for a moment. She opened her mouth. I was standing a little to one side and was able to study her without being noticed. I thought she was going to speak, to give a shout. I was expecting a cry. I was prepared for the most barbarous language, but not for the strange sounds that came out of her throat. Specifically, out of her throat, for neither mouth nor tongue played any part in this sort of shrill mewing or whining, which seemed yet again to express the joyful frenzy of an animal. In our zoos, sometimes, young chimpanzees play and wrestle together, giving just such little cries. Since, despite our astonishment, we forced ourselves to go on swimming without paying attention to her, she appeared to come to a decision. She lowered herself onto the rock, took purchase on it with her hands, and started climbing down towards us. Her agility was extraordinary. Her golden body, appearing to us through a cloud of spray and light, like a fairy tale vision, moved quickly down the rock face, along the thin transparent blade of the waterfall. In a few moments, clinging to some imperceptible projections, she was down on the level of the lake, kneeling on a flat stone. She watched us a few seconds longer, then took to the water and swam over towards us. We realized she wanted to play, and therefore spontaneously continued with our frolics, which had given her such confidence, modifying our movements whenever she looked startled. Soon we were all involved in a game of which she had unconsciously laid down the rules. A strange game indeed, bearing a certain resemblance to the evolutions of seals in a pool, which consisted in her fleeing from us and approaching us alternately, suddenly veering away when we were almost within reach, then drawing so close as to graze us without ever actually coming into contact.
It was childish. But what would we not have done in order to tame the beautiful stranger? I noticed that Professor Antel took part in this play with unconcealed pleasure. This session had been going on for some time, and we were getting out of breath, when I was struck by the paradoxical nature of the girl's expression, her solemnity. There she was, taking manifest pleasure in these games she was inspiring, yet not a smile had appeared on her face. For some time this had given me a vague feeling of uneasiness, without my knowing exactly why. I was now relieved to discover the reason. She neither laughed nor smiled. She only uttered from time to time one of those little cries from her throat, which evidently expressed her satisfaction. I decided to make an experiment. As she approached me, cleaving the water with a peculiar swimming action which resembled a dog's, and with her hair streaming out like the tail of a comet, I looked her straight in the eye, and before she could turn her head aside, bestowed on her a smile, imbued with all the friendliness and affection that I could muster. The result was surprising. She stopped swimming, stood up in the water which reached to her waist, and raised her hands in front of her in a gesture of defense. Then she turned her back on me and raced for the shore. Having got out of the water, she paused and half turned round, looking at me askance, as she had on the ledge, with a startled air of an animal that had just seen something alarming. Perhaps she might have regained her confidence, for the smile had frozen on my lips and I had started swimming again in an innocent manner, but a fresh incident renewed her emotion. We heard a noise in the forest, and, tumbling from branch to branch, our friend Hector came into view, landed on his feet, and scampered over towards us, overjoyed at finding us again. I was amazed to see the bestial expression, compounded of fright and menace, that came over the young girl's face when she caught sight of the monkey. She drew back, hugging the rocks so closely as to melt into them, every muscle tensed, her back arched, her hands contracted like claws. All this on account of a nice little chimpanzee who was about to make much of us. It was as he passed close by, without noticing her, that she sprang out. Her body twanged like a bow. She seized him by the throat and closed her hands round his neck, while she held the poor wretch firm between her thighs. Her attack was so swift that we did not even have time to intervene. The monkey hardly struggled. He stiffened after a few seconds and fell dead when she let go of him. This gorgeous creature, in a romantic flight of fancy I had christened her Nova, being able to compare her appearance only to that of a brilliant star, Nova had, with her own hands, strangled a harmless pet animal. When, having recovered from our stupor, we rushed towards her, it was far too late to save Hector. She turned to face us. As though to defend herself, her arms again raised in front of her, her lips curled back in a menacing attitude which brought us to a standstill. Then she uttered a last shrill cry, which could be interpreted as a shout of triumph or a bellow of rage, and fled into the forest. In a few seconds she had disappeared into the undergrowth, which closed back on her golden body, leaving us standing aghast in the middle of the jungle, which was once again completely silent.